Except for occasions when people actively sought his aid, the master did not stir from his meditation in Guanyin Cave. Month after month, he endured the dank surroundings as he concentrated on deepening his skill in meditation. One day, however, a ruckus outside the cave attracted his attention. He went outside to find two muscular workmen attempting to remove a large boulder from the ground in front of the cave. Although the men were tough, their brute strength could not budge the boulder, mostly because they were going about it all wrong. They were standing on the downhill side, trying to rock the boulder loose. After a few strenuous but unsuccessful attempts, they gave up and made preparations to dynamite it. The master decided to join the fun. "Wait a minute," he said. "Let me try for you." The master piled a few rocks near the boulder on the uphill side to act as a fulcrum, braced his staff under the edge of the rock, pressed down firmly on the lever, and single-handedly sent the boulder crashing down the mountainside. The workmen stood there in dumbfounded amazement. "You should hire me in their place," laughed the master, as the foreman approached in time to see the monk send the boulder bounding down the hill. "Not only am I more resourceful than your two men, but I eat only one meal a day. If you hire me, you'd cut your payroll in half and save the cost of 5 meals a day." With that, the master walked back into the cave. After the master cured the prominent merchant's niece, word of his compassion and skill began to spread rapidly throughout Hong Kong, and more visitors came to Guanyin Cave to pay their respects, to ask for help, or merely to satisfy their curiosity. Among those who heard stories of the master's compassion was Upasika, laywoman, Xia Guoman, who later, in 1974, joined the Sangha upon receiving the Shramanarika precepts from the master in America. Although Upasika Guoman was afraid of bhikshus, she felt drawn to the master. One day, she summoned the courage to approach Guanyin Cave. There she found the master preparing to take his daily meal, which on that day consisted of noodles. The master invited her to join him, but Guoman, due to her fear of bhikshus, declined. However, after she had sat in the cave for a while, she felt more at ease and eventually accepted some food and a cup of water from the clear mountain spring which flowed outside the cave. "This water is sweeter than honey," she exclaimed after taking a sip. "Do you put sugar in it?" "No," replied the master. "How could it be so naturally sweet?" she exclaimed once again. "If it tastes sweet, then drink more," suggested the master. "Perhaps it is sweet dew from Guanyin Bodhisattva." Guoman drank 4 or 5 large bowls of water during that first visit. She also noticed the tattered condition of the master's rag robe, which he had worn ever since his cultivation in Manchuria during the long journey south, and now in Guanyin Cave. The first thing she did when she left the cave was to spend some of her hard-earned money to buy cloth to make the master some new clothes. After that first visit, Guoman often returned to pay her respects to the master. Every time she came, she would drink a quantity of the sweet spring water. Her faith deepened, and she felt no fear in the master's presence. After several months in the cave, the master built a small reed hut outside. As soon as it was finished, obstacles arose, for when Bhikshu Guang Dao, who lived nearby, saw the hut, his jealousy was aroused. He rushed down the mountain to inform the residents of Julin Yuan Temple of the construction project taking place at Guanyin Cave. Why should this temple have to pay for that monk's food when he's obviously got money of his own? Demanded Guang Dao. If he's rich enough to build a thatched hut, he's rich enough to buy his own food. If I were you, I wouldn't make offerings to him any more when he comes begging for food. The manager of the temple, Mao Xue, followed Guang Dao's advice, and the next time the master came to the temple to get food, he was refused. Having been denied his meal, the master simply returned to the cave and continued to meditate. Up until that time, the temple had been virtually his sole source of food. He did not tell anyone else about the turn of events, however, but merely remained in meditation. 2 weeks passed, and the master continued to sit without any food. In the village below the cave lived a layman of very short stature in his late 50s. He had been bitten on the foot by a dog some 3 months earlier, and the wound had festered and stubbornly refused to heal. Doctors and specialists had been unable to help him. One night, Layman Lao dreamed 3 times that Dharma protector Weito Bodhisattva came to him and said, "If you want your foot to heal, you should go make offerings to Dharma Master Anzi, who is in Guanyin Cave on Furong Mountain." Then, in his dreams, he clearly saw the master sitting in the cave. "If you make offerings to that Dharma Master," continued Weito, "your foot will get well and not give you any more trouble." The next morning, the layman, remembering the dreams, purchased 30 pounds of rice, scraped together another $70, and set out up the mountain. The difficulty he had in walking made the climb an especially long one. When he reached the gate behind Julin Chanyuan Temple and started up the path which led to Guanyin Cave, Dharma Master Guang Dao recognized him as a Dharma protector bearing offerings and rushed out to greet him. "Does Dharma Master Anzi live here?" asked Layman Lao.
"I'm the manager here," replied Guang Dao. "You can leave the offerings with me. I will see that they are placed in good hands."
"You don't look like the monk I saw in my dream," said the layman. "Weito Bodhisattva said his name was Anzi, and I am bringing these things for him."
Hearing this, Guang Dao got angry. "What do you mean they aren't for me? I'm the manager here. Any offerings made up here are to be given to me."
"But you are not the monk I saw in my dream," countered the layman. "I must give them to him, not to you." Their discussion grew more and more heated until finally they were screaming at one another. The noise brought the master out of his cave to see what was happening. When the layman caught sight of the master, he cried, "That's the monk I saw in my dream! These offerings are for him!" On hearing this, Guang Dao became even more irate. The master questioned the layman, and learning of the dreams and the instructions by Weito Bodhisattva, he said, "It really doesn't matter whether you make the offerings to me or to some other monk. You can make offerings to me if you wish, but there is another Dharma master here as well. He and I are together. Although we eat separately, we divide all our food in half." Taken aback at the master's generosity, Guang Dao stood by speechless as the master carefully divided the rice and money equally between them. As a result of the incident, the master did not starve, and Layman Lao's foot completely healed. Lao was so moved by the experience that he spread the story of the master's power and compassion far and wide, and grew so fond of speaking Dharma that he acquired the nickname, Homegrown Dharma Master. As word of the three dreams and the miraculous healing spread through Hong Kong, Dharma protectors began to climb the mountain regularly with offerings for the master. Even though the local temple refused to feed him,
The master didn't starve, and he always divided the offerings equally with Dharma Master Guang Dao. Nonetheless, Guang Dao continued to slander him so severely that the master decided to leave the mountain. The next time She Guo Man climbed the mountain to pay her respects to the master, she found not only that he had quietly departed from the cave, but also saw that the two springs which fed the two clear pools of sweet water in front of Guanyin Cave had dried up. Western Bliss Gardens. The master now began construction of a new Bodhi Manda, Way Place, which he was to name Shila Yuan, Western Bliss Gardens. It was built on the upper ridge of Ma Shan Village in Si Wan He, Hong Kong. By day, the master oversaw the construction. At night, he continued to give sutra lectures, and at all times, he responded to people's needs. Although the site of the new Bodhi Manda was for the most part a favorable one, it had one major drawback. There was no water. In fact, the entire mountainside suffered from an insufficient and unreliable water supply. The neighbors had to go all the way down the mountain on trails, and then along the road through the marketplace to get water from the city of Hong Kong. Those who lived above, on the peak, went down to a public pump where there was usually a long, dragon-like line of people waiting for water. On their return up the mountain, they had to cart the water up a flight of more than 300 steps. Furthermore, the mountain roads that led to the water supply were precipitous and hazardous. The water situation on the mountain was so deplorable that the mere mention of the topic would bring a pallor to people's faces and groans of exasperation. Before the construction of Western Bliss Gardens, several of the master's disciples brought this problem to his attention. He listened patiently to their analysis of the situation, but seemed unconcerned. For the next several months, he was immersed in work, arranging, planning, and supervising the construction of the temple. He printed no advertisements, asked for no donations, dropped no hints to wealthy laymen, and did not go begging from door to door. To take advantage of Hong Kong's affluence went contrary to the guiding principles the master had taught his disciples. Freezing, we do not scheme. Starving, we do not beg. Dying of poverty, we ask for nothing. We accord with conditions, but do not change. We do not change, yet accord with conditions. These are our three great principles. We renounce our lives to do the Buddha's work. We shape our lives to be capable of making revolution in the Sangha order. In our actions, we understand the principles, so that our principles are revealed in our actions. We carry out the pulse of the patriarch's mind transmission. The master chose to draw only on voluntary resources, which in large part consisted of his own strength, his own determination, and his own faith in bringing the pure Bodhi Manda to fruition. Western Bliss Gardens was to be the resting place of the extremely efficacious and miraculous image of Amitabha Buddha, which the master had brought with him from Manchuria. It was the image he had made obeisance to during his early years of cultivation, and as a result of the extreme purity of the master's heart, the graceful porcelain figure had gradually undergone a miraculous transformation. As the master continued to bow with ever-deepening sincerity before the image, A distinct rosy hue began to suffuse the once snow-white porcelain, until eventually it took on the glow of living flesh. The connection between the master and the miraculous image of Amitabha Buddha is one of utmost purity that far transcends the kind of attachment found in the realm of dualism. In a most profound sense, the image could be said to be indispensable to the master. Nevertheless, after the master arrived in Hong Kong and began to meditate in Guanyin Cave, he had no appropriate place to respectfully make offerings to the Buddha image and had to ask two Dharma masters who had a temple to keep it for him so that it could be properly cared for, respected, and worshipped. The Dharma masters accepted the image with the full understanding that they would return it to the master when he had an appropriate place for it. During the period of more than a year that the master spent meditating in Guanyin Cave, however, the two monks developed a fondness for the exquisite image and no longer wished to remember that it had only been loaned to them. They considered it their own. When the master decided to establish Western Bliss Garden, it was Amitabha Buddha whom he called upon to aid him in carrying out the work. Once he moved to the grounds and the construction of the temple began, he asked the two monks to return the image of Amitabha Buddha. Not wishing to comply but lacking any justification for refusing his request, the two monks came to pay special New Year's greetings to the master. Kneeling before the master, they said ingratiatingly, "We just cannot bear to part with the Amitabha Buddha image, and so we have decided to kneel here until the Dharma master consents to let us keep it." They knelt for 5 hours before the master, who used many expedient means to bring them to their senses. He scolded, he shouted, he was pointedly rude to them. He picked up his teapot and slammed it down on the floor in front of them. He hurled his teacup against the wall, smashing it to smithereens. But even his most extreme attempts to teach and transform them were to no avail. The two remained rooted to the floor, sustained by their greed for the Buddha image. Since he couldn't frighten them into waking up, the master decided that at least he could physically remove them from the Buddha hall and perhaps jar them to their senses. Although each monk weighed over 200 pounds, he grabbed them under the armpits one at a time and dragged them outside. But by the time he had evicted one monk and had a good grip on the second, the first had returned and was kneeling once more. After the master deposited the second monk on the doorstep and walked back to evict the first, the second was already following close on his heels. Realizing that the two failed to understand the seriousness of the matter, the master turned from the expedient to the actual and attempted to explain to the monks the nature of the ineffable, mysterious, and wonderful affinity which existed between himself and that spiritually efficacious Amitabha Buddha image. "With that image, I can realize Buddhahood. Without it, I cannot," he told them. "However," he added quietly, "if you want the image so badly, then take it." Heedless of the master's first statement, the two monks only heard that at last the master had relinquished the image. Satisfied, they got up and left. "Don't ever set foot in my door again," warned the master as they departed. But the master had spoken the truth, and by the next day, in the absence of the Amitabha Buddha image, he had fallen seriously ill. Day by day his fever rose. Since he lived alone and few people even knew where to find him, there was no one to fix gruel or fetch water for him. As a result, he rapidly grew weaker and weaker, and his condition became grave. Eventually, Bhikshu Heng Yue, who lived in the same temple as the two offending monks, learned of their outrageous display on New Year's Day and of the master's subsequent illness. Heng Yue carried the Amitabha Buddha image back to the master, and with its return, the master's illness subsided, and the construction of the Bodhimanda progressed rapidly. As Western Bliss Gardens neared completion, the master began landscaping the grounds with young pine, papaya, and bamboo trees. Hong Kong has always been ravaged by several typhoons each year, and that year, when the winds hit, they lashed through the gardens of the Bodhimanda and ripped out the newly planted trees. When the master saw the devastated gardens and the uprooted seedlings, he laid down an ultimatum, vowing, "As long as I am in Hong Kong, there will not be any more typhoons. My departure from Hong Kong will be another matter, but as long as I am here, destructive storms will not touch Hong Kong." After that, during the more than 10 years the master remained in Hong Kong, not a single typhoon struck the city. Time and again, typhoon warnings were displayed, but each time the storm either died out or changed course. The immunity of the city was dramatically evidenced when on several occasions, storms beat a straight course for Hong Kong, only to veer off suddenly from as close as 15 miles offshore. It was only in 1960, when the master left for Australia, that Hong Kong was hit by a massive typhoon, which did vast amounts of damage. The goal of founding a pure Bodhimanda was realized in December 1951. The new Bodhimanda was given the name Western Bliss Gardens and respectfully dedicated to the three Tathagatas, Akshopya, Amitabha, and Shakyamuni. Opening ceremonies were held on May 1, 1952, the birthday of the world-honored one, Shakyamuni Buddha. Since supplies at the new temple were scarce, there was no food and no bowls, no plates or utensils, the fourfold assembly of monks, nuns, laymen, and laywomen planned to serve tea and peanuts at the opening ceremony. At that time, Le Guoming, a lay disciple of the master, was troubled by a constant and severe pain in her arm. She finally went to ask the master to cure it. He replied that she should do meritorious works. When Le Guoming learned from others in the assembly that there was no food for the opening and no utensils for serving, she took advantage of the opportunity to completely outfit the temple with serving utensils. She went on to provide a sumptuous vegetarian feast on the day of the opening. After the feast, Guoming was still experiencing severe pain. She said to the master, "My arm is still paralyzed." And she showed him how she couldn't move it past a horizontal position. The master replied, "Raise up your arm." She did as she was told and was cured. After the master officially moved into Western Bliss Gardens, he found a crack in a stone at the base of the cliff behind the temple. He knelt before the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and prayed for a sweet spring on the site, and every day recited the Great Compassion Mantra several times before the cleft. Soon, a little moisture appeared at the cleft, and gradually, drop by drop, the water began to flow. Sweet dew began pouring forth and flowing down to form an abundant pool. The serious problem of Western Bliss Gardens' water supply had been resolved by the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. When news of the miraculous spring spread, everyone in the neighborhood was astonished. How could water flow from a dry rock on that barren mountain? Once the waters were brought forth, the winds quelled, and the construction finished, a serenity settled over the jewel-like temple. Behind it was a protecting red rock cliff. It was bordered by young green gardens, and it afforded a view across the city of Hong Kong to the blue waters which surrounded the island. In fact, anyone attuned to it felt a pervasive sense of peace and quiet as soon as he entered the front gate. Right outside the front gate, visitors found themselves in the midst of hubbub. The cries of vendors and barkers advertising their wares, the chatter, laughter, and quarrels of the hundreds of small children weaving in and out of the narrow streets, and rickety stairs of the hillside slums, and the street noises and factory racket which filtered up from the city below. But as soon as one stepped inside the grounds of the Bodhimanda, the sounds ceased. The air was pure and cool, and a profound stillness prevailed. Those who noticed this obvious change might have been tempted to examine the fence and gate that ran along the front of the property to see if some scientific device had been installed to muffle the noise. But the fence and gate were not at all out of the ordinary. Those with faith and understanding realized that the extraordinarily pure and cool quiet which cloaked the temple and grounds was a miraculous response from the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, who were offering protection to those who came to worship and cultivate there. Faith, vows, and practice. In 1950, prior to construction of Western Bliss Gardens, a group of people who supported and protected the Bodhimanda and deeply respecting the master, asked him to lecture on the Sutra of the Past Vows of Earth Store Bodhisattva. The lectures were given at Dongshan Tan Temple and ran for more than 40 days in November and December. A daily audience of more than 100 people listened as the Dharma banner was firmly placed and raised high, and the door of expediencies were opened with expert skill. The master's lectures were so dynamic that the inanimate paper and ink came alive, as the listeners seemed to find themselves on the shores of the seething seas of hell, brimmed with fire and inhabited by vicious creatures who attacked offenders as they plummeted helplessly into the boiling waters. The Dharma assembly listened spellbound as the Brahmin woman, raising her voice against the agonized cries of the hellbound, questioned the Ghost King Poisonless about the whereabouts of her deceased mother. The master conveyed the principles of the sutra with such clarity and incisiveness that everyone who heard his lectures gained in wisdom. Even those whose conditions were not yet ripe planted seeds of Bodhi, which soon sprouted forth. One young disciple, Tan Guojung, who attended those lectures, relates, "I made a practice of accompanying my aging father everywhere, and I often went with him to Dongshan Tan to pay respects to our ancestors. I recall I would lean against the iron railing of the balcony outside and watch what went on because I disliked the incense smoke, which burned my eyes. Once, when Dharma Master Doolin was lecturing the Earth Store Sutra, I stopped up my ears because I imagined that hearing what he said would be sinful. Even now, I have no memory of the Dharma Master's kind and concentrated efforts to cause that group of prodigal sons to return home more quickly. Why did I react that way? As soon as belief in the Buddha or the practice of bowing to the holy beings was mentioned, most young people of the so-called new generation dismissed it as superstitious nonsense. Thus influenced, I was equally confused and could not see beyond this prejudiced point of view. I was like a frog sitting in the bottom of a well. Since I grew up in Hong Kong, which was predominantly Catholic, and what is more, since I attended parochial schools in my childhood, I first believed in the one all-powerful and all-loving God. I was also part of a society which by and large revered neither God nor the Buddha. In popular movies, Sangha members of former times were often depicted in a most degrading and derogatory light. Influences like these caused me to conceive a mistaken but thorough dislike for Buddhism. About a month after my father heard the lecture on the Earth Store Sutra, he suddenly understood what he had experienced during the lecture and announced that he wanted to find that Dharma master. I reluctantly accompanied him. When we arrived at the second floor of the Dai Gong Fabric Company, where the master had been invited to reside by the owner, John Sui Zhang, I saw that every gesture of the monk dressed in ragged robes expressed compassion. He appeared totally different to me from what I had seen and remembered of other monks, and I experienced a feeling of utmost respect for him. The master proclaimed the deep and mysterious principles of the Great Vehicle and the all-transcending absolute truth of Buddhism in such a way that I was caused to awaken as if from a dream. He gave me a copy of the Earth Store Sutra, which reminded me of the day I had attended his lecture and plugged up my ears, and I felt an overwhelming, unutterable shame. From that day on, I have had a strong interest in Buddhism. After his sudden awakening upon hearing the master's lectures on the Earth Store Sutra, the elder Tan went searching for the master in order to hear more of the wonderful Dharma, to take refuge with the Triple Jewel, and to bow to the master as his teacher. Not long after he took refuge, his wife, Gan Guoyan, his daughters, Tan Guozheng and Tan Guoshi, and other members of his family also became disciples. Tan Guopu has been told by a fortune teller who used the standard Chinese divination system, which employs 8 characters, 2 each for the year, the month, the day, and the time of birth, that he was destined to die at the age of 78. Disturbed by this prediction and unhappy at the thought of leaving his young children fatherless, Upasaka Tan expressed his deep faith in the master and requested that his life be extended 10 years beyond the day predicted for his death. The master replied that he could grant him more than that. He could guarantee that Upasaka Tan would live for 12 more years if, during those years, he was able to maintain deep faith, sincerely rely upon and vigorously support the Triple Jewel of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and propagate the orthodox Dharma. Upasaka Tan proved to be a worthy disciple and was able to live out the extra 12 years. He died a peaceful death at the ripe old age of 90. Upasaka Tan Guopu's young daughters, Tan Guozheng and Tan Guoshi, continued to study with the master, attended various summer study sessions and winter meditation sessions, learned the chants, rituals, and ceremonies, and translated the master's Mandarin discourses into Cantonese and English when he spoke the Dharma. Wherever he goes, the master is surrounded by young people. Hong Kong was no exception to this, but the youths who were drawn to him there were received differently than those who had become his disciples in Shuangcheng County, Manchuria, where the master had spent the first 30 years of his life. Since Shuangcheng County was rural, people lived simply and emphasized the virtues of family life. Respect for one's elders was a hard and fast rule. When young people in Manchuria wish to become the master's disciples and to learn to meditate, he was stern and unequivocal in his reply. Only if you agree to bow to your parents every single day and to do so with utmost sincerity. Those who agreed to this were accepted as disciples. Those who could not were not accepted. The youth in Hong Kong were a different matter. They had been influenced by the West's stress on independence and freedom, and in the constantly changing city environment, the family structure had lost some of its cohesiveness. Young people often rejected the suggestions of their parents and struck out on their own at quite an early age. The methods used by the master changed accordingly. He no longer demanded that the youngsters bow to their parents, for such an idea would have met with nothing short of an incredulous laughter by the sophisticated youth. Rather than filial piety, the master stressed the principle of self-reliance, that the Buddha nature is inherent in each living being, but that it is up to each individual to find a way to uncover and reveal it. Once a young person took refuge and began to seriously study the Buddha Dharma, however, the master was every bit as stern and exacting in accord with Hong Kong's conditions as he had been in Manchuria, be the disciples young or old. Another young disciple who heard the master's lectures on the Earth Store Sutra was Man Guomi. Guomi had been afflicted with heart disease from the age of 6. His heart had become so enlarged that doctors ordered him to stay in bed for at least 5 years. After 5 years of sleep, however, he could sleep no longer and he began to have fantasies of flying. One day he saw a book with a picture of a monk inside. People told him that the monk was Chan Master Dulin, and after that, although his family and friends practiced the recitation of Namo Amitabha Buddha, he sat in bed, palms together, reciting Namo Dharma Master Dulin. At first he had no great response and continued to have fantasies of flying. After about 70 days of recitation, however, a strange thing happened. As he faced the image and began to recite, the monk on the cover stepped out of the book, stretched out his hand, gently rubbed the child's head and spoke to him. Up to that time he had never met the master, and yet after that incident he was completely healed, stopped taking all his medicine, and left the doctors dumbfounded. He then went to pay his respects to the master, who was lecturing on the Earth Store Sutra at the time. The boy took refuge and was given the Dharma name Guomi, and soon he began to practice meditation. As a rule, the master did not teach the principles of Dhyana Samadhi when he was in Hong Kong, but if someone wanted to study meditation, he had to do the work alone. That is what Guomi did. At school, when the others went out to play at recess, Guomi would go to the mountain or to the men's lavatory to meditate. Like the Buddha's son, Rahula, he could enter samadhi anywhere, even in the bathroom. After about a year of this, his Buddha eye opened and every situation became crystal clear to him. He had been slow in school, but after taking refuge, he could commit anything to memory by reading it only once, and he quickly advanced 5 grade levels. Guomi spoke fluent English and was able to translate for the master when English-speaking people came to pay their respects. But because he was so short, people sometimes wouldn't take him seriously in spite of his skills. Visitors took one look at him and decided that he was incapable of getting the message across. One day, the master laid down an ultimatum. "Hurry up and grow," he said. "You're so short that everyone thinks you are a child no matter how well you speak. They don't trust you." Guomi was very obedient. He returned home and grew 3 inches in 1 week. Now he is taller than the master, who is quite tall by Chinese standards. When the master lectured sutras, Guo Mi, who could also translate the master's Mandarin into Cantonese, would use his Buddha eye to learn what the master was thinking without waiting for him to speak. The master would say a sentence, and then Guo Mi would supply the details in his translation, allowing the master to rest. Although he spoke the doctrine very completely, some people were put out. The master didn't say nearly that much. Why is that kid doing so much talking? They would complain. In reference to this, the master has said, "Actually, he was saying what I was telling him to say, and he knows this through the use of the Buddha eye. Our doctrines are the same. I select them, and he speaks them." Guo Mi's older sister, Wan Guo Shu, another of the master's devoted young disciples in Hong Kong, was especially affected by the magnitude of the master's vow. In an article she wrote, "The venerable master has vowed that after he becomes enlightened, he will cause all living beings to awaken to the way, just as he has, and then and only then will he traverse upward to experience the perfection of enlightenment and practice. The Buddha position." By reading the 18 great vows of the master, you will know what kind of Sangha member he is. His vows, great like Amitabha Buddha's, are these: "I bow before the Buddhas of the 10 directions, the Dharma of the Tripitaka, and the Holy Sangha of the past and present, praying that they will hear and bear witness. I, disciple Dulun, Ansi, resolve not to seek for myself either the blessings of the gods or of men, or the attainments of the Shravakas, Pratyeka Buddhas, or high bodhisattvas. Instead, I rely on the most supreme vehicle, the one Buddha vehicle, and bring forth the heart of Bodhi, vowing that all living beings of the Dharma realm shall attain the unsurpassed, proper, and equal right enlightenment at the same time as I. 1. I vow that I will not attain the right enlightenment if there is even one bodhisattva in the 10 directions and the 3 periods of time to the end of empty space and the Dharma realm who has not yet become a Buddha. 2. I vow that I will not attain the right enlightenment if there is even one Pratyeka Buddha in the 10 directions and the 3 periods of time to the end of empty space and the Dharma realm who has not yet become a Buddha. 3. I vow that I will not attain the right enlightenment if there is even one Shravaka in the 10 directions and the 3 periods of time to the end of empty space and the Dharma realm who has not become a Buddha. 4. I vow that I will not attain the right enlightenment if there is even one God in the triple world who has not yet become a Buddha. 5. I vow that I will not attain the right enlightenment if there is even one human being in the worlds of the 10 directions who has not yet become a Buddha. 6. I vow that I will not attain the right enlightenment if there is even one Asura who has not yet become a Buddha. 7. I vow that I will not attain the right enlightenment if there is even one animal who has not yet become a Buddha. 8. I vow that I will not attain the right enlightenment if there is even one hungry ghost who has not yet become a Buddha. 9. I vow that I will not attain the right enlightenment if there is even one being in the hells who has not yet become a Buddha. 10. I vow that I will not attain the right enlightenment if there is any being in the triple world who has taken refuge with me and has not yet become a Buddha, be it a god, immortal, human being, or asura, bird, fish, plant, animal, magical dragon, beast, ghost, or spirit. 11. I vow to bestow upon all living beings of the Dharma realm all the blessings and happiness I am destined to receive. 12. I vow to take upon myself the miseries of all living beings of the Dharma realm, that I alone may endure them on their behalf. 13. I vow that my spirit shall enter the hearts of all living beings who do not believe in the Buddha Dharma, causing them to reform their evil conduct and practice the good, and causing them to take refuge with the Triple Jewel and ultimately realize Buddhahood. 14. I vow that every living being who has seen my face or even heard my name will bring forth a Bodhi heart and quickly realize the Buddha way. 15. I vow to observe reverently the Buddha's regulations and take only one meal a day, and that at midday. 16. I vow to enlighten all living beings according to their dispositions. 17. I vow in this very life to attain the 5 eyes and 6 spiritual penetrations and the ability to fly freely. 18. I vow that all my vows will be fulfilled. I believe that after reading these 18 vows which the Master has made, anyone can clearly understand the Master's life work. From these vows, one can know that he has firm determination and awesome energy, yet his kind-heartedness is such that he constantly disregards himself for the sake of others. He thoroughly understands the nature of all disasters and difficulties in the world, and in all circumstances he takes on our endless sufferings. He wishes to cause all living beings to become Buddhas. He wishes to banish all the confusion and anxiety of mankind and resolve society's problems. To accomplish these aims, he relies solely on self-sacrifice, on compassion, on all-encompassing affection for living beings, on vast dharmas, and on equanimity. Wan Guojun and his sister, Guo Song, also took refuge with the Master when they were quite young. Their mother, Le Guoming, was a devoted Buddhist and took her children to meet the Master as soon as she learned of his inconceivable and miraculous dharma. After Wan Guojun took refuge, he stayed close to the Master to receive his teaching and to serve him in any way he could. He attended the numerous summer and winter sessions the Master held at Western Bliss Gardens, and during the years Guojun was completing his education, he also served as the Master's translator during Dharma lectures, keeping detailed notes. Wan Guojun's features reveal the physiognomy of a warlord. This does not refer to a coarse and vulgar bandit, but rather to the heroic and able leaders of history who retreated with their followers to secure mountaintops in the face of hostile and oppressive governments. Many such bandits became benevolent and capable rulers and gained large followings. It is not surprising then, especially because of Guo Jun's continuing protection of the Dharma, that while still young, he became the director and general manager of a textile plant in Nigeria, where he now supervises more than 4,000 employees. His sister, Wang Guo Song, relates the following incident. One autumn, my mother became involved in some very unpleasant matters and as a result became very ill. Her face was chalk white, and she was bedridden and in great pain. There was no improvement in her condition despite consultation and treatment by several doctors. And what is more, the doctors said that her illness was deeply entrenched and could not be cured. Other members of the family became seriously depressed by this news, and I was very disturbed. Consequently, I prayed before the Buddha, hoping that the Bodhisattvas would bless my mother. As I prayed, all of a sudden I was astounded by a brilliant white light which poured out before me, and I saw a monk sitting in meditation within the light in front of the Buddha image. It was my teacher. I was extremely happy to see him, and yet I continued to recite the Buddha's name. Before that happened, my mother had not slept for days, but after I saw the master, although her face was very pale and her life force seemed extremely weak, she slept. It was midnight, and I asked a friend to accompany me to see the master. As soon as I saw him, he said, "I already know about your mother's illness. Go home quickly, recite the Buddha's name, and meditate on the name of the Buddha. The Buddhas and Bodhisattvas will bless your mother." I went back home and prayed the whole night through. By the next evening, my mother had recovered from her sickness. While the master was still building Western Bliss Gardens, he was visited by a man named Zhang Yi Gai. Since the master had not announced his move from Guanyin Cave, nor made any attempt to publicize the establishment of the new Bodhi Manda, few people knew where he was. But occasionally there were those who learned of his whereabouts, and some climbed the mountain to the worksite to pay their respects to him. Zhang Yi Gai was a wealthy and successful drug manufacturer who discovered to his horror that he had become afflicted with cancer. Since the malignancy in his body was not diagnosed until it had reached an advanced stage, his physicians allotted him but a short time to live. In his fear, he sought out the most skilled doctors, 6 famous specialists in all. His efforts were in vain, however, as none could promise him more than 100 days of life. Fear gave rise to panic, and he advertised widely in the newspapers, offering rich rewards to anyone who could save his life. As death drew nearer, his fear gnawed at him more fiercely than the cancer. At that time, an elder layman named Ye went to visit Zhang, and later introduced him to the Venerable Master. As Zhang knelt before the Master and related the course of his disease, foremost in his mind was escaping Yama, King of Death, and so he said that he would do anything to obtain a stay of execution. The Master wasted no words with Upasaka Zhang, but told him that if he did as instructed, he could win him a reprieve from his imminent death. "If you follow my instructions, I guarantee you that you will not die within 100 days, nor will you die of cancer in the future. But you must be very careful to fulfill your vows, paying attention to every detail as if you were walking on thin ice. First, take refuge with the Triple Jewel and become a faithful Buddhist disciple. Second, establish affinities with the Sangha in Hong Kong and vicinity, for the merit derived from the united power of the Sangha of the Ten Directions can protect your life. Thousands of people who have left the home life are now coming here from the mainland to carry on their practice because they are unable to do so in their native land. You should make offerings to each of these refugees, giving each one $20, Hong Kong, and a bolt of good cloth. Upasaka Zhang agreed. On the 12th of June, he became a disciple of the Master, and during the ceremony, in a miraculous vision, he saw the Bodhisattva Guanyin pour sweet dew on his head. And then he vowed, "I will fulfill my promise to make offerings to all the Sangha members in Hong Kong vicinity. And furthermore, if I do not die, I will help the Venerable Master propagate the Buddha Dharma by making an offering of $200,000 in American money." At that time in Hong Kong, there was a Dharma Master named Ding Xi, a monk who later became abbot of Dong Lin Buddha Recitation Hall. When Ding Xi heard that Zhang had taken refuge with the Master, he fell prey to jealousy and instructed his disciples to convince Zhang to change teachers. This is how he tricked Zhang. Ding Xi had proclaimed himself the teacher of the Venerable Master Hua, even though the Master was still in Manchuria at the time, thousands of miles away, and had never even heard of Dharma Master Ding Xi. Ding Xi was able to make people believe this false claim, however, and so when the Master arrived in Hong Kong and word of his virtue spread, Ding Xi was able to capitalize on the Master's reputation. If a disciple is great, how much the more the teacher? Right after Zhang became the Master's disciple, Ding Xi instructed his monks to begin a 49-day medicine master repentance ceremony on Zhang's behalf. Collaborating with him closely in his plans were Upasika, Li Shiye, wife of the Hong Kong government official, Li Rongshan, and a relative of Zhang, and Lin Sha An, a friend of Zhang's who introduced Zhang to Ding Xi. By the time the 100 days allotted by the doctors had passed, Zhang's cancer had completely disappeared. Ding Xi had made every effort to advertise the medicine master repentance and other spiritual practices which were being undertaken to effect Zhang's cure, and immediately attributed Zhang's miraculous recovery to the effectiveness of his own efforts. Then, by suggesting many times that the teacher is perforce more powerful than the disciple, Ding Xi eventually managed to delude Zhang. As a result, Upasaka Zhang began showering gifts upon Ding Xi and fell under his sway to such an extent that he even agreed to never see the Venerable Master Hua again. The Master who never speaks unnecessarily and does not boast said nothing and asked for no money. He simply waited patiently for Zhang to keep his word. During that time, instead of following his vows to the letter, Zhang gave only $5 and a bolt of cheap cloth to each Hong Kong Sangha member. The Master, not at all angered by Zhang's disloyal behavior, was in fact deeply concerned for his disciples' welfare, and even went so far as to represent Zhang as a proxy in the fulfillment of his vows so that he might continue to live. With great compassion, the Master begged or borrowed enough money to enable him to give to all the members of the Sangha in the Hong Kong vicinity, at the time numbering more than 4,000, $10 Hong Kong each. Moreover, two laymen, Upasikas Chen Rei Jiang and Yang Da Lin, both disciples of the Master who were moved by his compassionate selfless concern for all people, each donated 25 cents apiece to all members of the Sangha. The Master himself supervised the distribution of the goods. As a first step, the master notified all the monasteries and nunneries in Hong Kong and Kowloon of his intentions. He instructed members of the Sangha to register, asking each monastery to provide an estimate of the total number of recipients. Then he saw to the purchase of bolts of cloth and medicines. On the 12th of July, shortly after the items were procured, they were transported to Chuan Wen. The first stop was Dong Pu To Monastery, and next was Julin Chan School, and the Sarnath of Kowloon. The next morning, the distribution proceeded to Nan Tian Ju, Donglin Buddhist Recitation Hall, and Hung Fa College. On July 14th, the distribution was made at Hai Jiao Yan in Castle Peak, Yuanlong, and other places nearby. There were few monasteries and schools in Yuanlong, but many small chapels, so the master sent word to these to gather together in one place. Among the recipients were the bhikshunis of Yuan Tong Nunnery and Ling Yun Nunnery. After several days, they set out for Sha Tin. The Buddhist disciples of that area assembled at Prajna Cottage. Among the recipients were the bhikshus of Silin Monastery and the bhikshunis of Fa Cheng School, about 50 in all. Those who were distributing the goods drove back to Kowloon in a hired car to Da Fo Monastery on Huang Da Xian. Then they went on to Jilin Cottage in Diamond Hill. At each distribution point, they first assembled the bhikshus and bhikshunis, and then called the roll, according to the registration, for them to receive their gifts. Each one got a bolt of cloth, a box of medicine, and $15.50, Hong Kong. After the visit to each monastery, if there had been names missed during roll call, or if the people had forgotten to register, their names were submitted, the lists were checked, and then later visits were made to supply them with their gifts. Distribution to the monasteries and nunneries of Da Yu Mountain were entrusted to Dharma Master Fa Kuo, the abbot of Bao Lian Monastery. In this way, all the bhikshus and bhikshunis in Hong Kong and Kowloon were benefited. The master handled the matter very efficiently so that there was no discord or confusion. Everyone involved in the distribution came to have deep respect for him. The master waited patiently for 8 years more for Upasaka Zhang to fulfill the rest of his vows. Finally, on the first day of the new year, 1960, 8 years after Zhang had made his promise, during an address before an assembly of over 100 Buddhists, the master announced, "If Zhang Yugai asks me for anything this year, even if he kneels outside my door for 3 years, I will not pay the slightest attention to him. I have waited 8 years and he has not fulfilled his vow." Shortly after that announcement, Zhang again became ill with cancer. He quickly sent relatives to see the Venerable Master, but the door remained closed. The stern integrity which consistently characterizes the Master's work among people was the object of a good deal of criticism in Hong Kong in this case. Many monks accused him of not understanding the Buddha Dharma because he ignored a layman like Zhang who was rich in meritorious deeds. The master wasn't moved. When Zhang, in a desperate play to win the master's favor, sent a servant with an offering of 200 Hong Kong dollars, the master threw the money out the window down into the street. "Sins of unmitigated arrogance," roared the other Dharma masters furiously. Ding Xi said, "He's left the home life and he will not accept offerings so that worthy laymen can earn merit and escape their afflictions, diseases, and karmic obstacles. Totally unprincipled. Totally inhumane." Within 100 days, Zhang died of cancer. The inexorable workings of karma cannot be arrested, and when a sage is slighted, scorned, or slandered, the karmic offense is heavy indeed. And so it was that Lin Xia'an, the man who had introduced Zhang to Dharma Master Ding Xi, was discovered to have cancer shortly after Zhang died. And after Lin's death, Dharma Master Ding Xi himself was found to have terminal cancer. Even if he had, as he pretended, cured Zhang's cancer, there was no cure for his own. Many Dharma masters in Hong Kong prayed and bowed repentances for Ding Xi, but there was no response. Within 2 years, he had to undergo his karmic retribution and died. After Ding Xi died, Li Shiye, the woman who had carried Ding Xi's messages to Zhang to entice him away from the Venerable Master, contracted cancer of the tongue and became unable to speak. If those people had not slandered the Master, Zhang would have continued to believe in the Master and would have lived to an old age and died peacefully. But when sages are slandered, the spiritual beings who protect the Dharma become unhappy, and in spite of the wishes of the sage, their response is quick and decisive. The higher the sage, the swifter and surer the reaction. Over the years, thousands of people came to Western Bliss Gardens. They attended the sutra lectures, bowed to the Buddha, participated in recitation sessions, and set up memorial plaques to dedicate the merit of these practices to their ancestors. Establishing an ancestral tablet or memorial plaque was ordinarily an expensive undertaking. But at Western Bliss Gardens, no large sums of money were charged for their installation. When people wanted to erect a plaque, they contributed what they felt they could. After the plaques were set up, the master transmitted the precepts to the departed spirits, both those who had died natural deaths and those who had been victims of accidents. Whenever ceremonies were conducted in the Great Hall, and whenever recitation sessions were held, the merit from the cultivation was transferred in part to the spirits of the deceased, who thereby came to be liberated from the bonds of their karma. One day, disciple Li Guohe set up a plaque for her relatives, but in her haste, neglected to include her deceased mother. After she left the temple and started down the hill towards her home, she suddenly experienced such severe pain in her legs that she could not take another step. When she turned around to return to the temple, however, she found to her surprise that she could walk without difficulty, even though it was uphill. When she returned to the temple, the master was there to meet her. "Didn't you forget to register your late mother?" he asked. She immediately realized her oversight and, grateful for the master's reminder, wrote down her mother's name. That time, when she started to descend the mountain, the acute pain was completely gone and she returned home with ease.